Hello and welcome to this episode of Invest Africa Insights. From COVID-19 to social protest movements and cybersecurity to political conflict, navigating security and safety risks is growing ever more complicated for businesses across Africa and around the world. To help us unpack this complex risk landscape, I'm delighted to be joined by Oliver Westmacott, President and COO of GardaWorld. Oliver, welcome to the programme.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
So GardaWorld is the world's largest privately owned security provider with operations across the African continent and, of course, globally as well. So, Oliver, you know, it's hard to imagine a year that's thrown up more unexpected challenges for businesses and communities than the last 12 months. Of course, there's the health risk, but there's also more general destabilization that can come with times of economic uncertainty, not to mention the many challenges that predated the pandemic, such as climate risk, cybersecurity, and social unrest. So to start us off, if you look at where GardaWorld is now and where you were at the start of 2020, how has the demand for your services changed over that time? And what new sort of security and safety needs have you seen emerging since the start of the pandemic?
Yeah, well, thank you. It's certainly been, you know, a fascinating time, and none of us could have foreseen what the past 12 months was going to deliver for us. And equally looking forwards this year in 2021, it remains extremely uncertain. And we've seen a number of changes to our business. And I think there's some positive news and some slightly less so and almost alarming in some respects. The economic impact, I think, is really going to be really enduring. And I think over time, the pinch of that is only going to become more and more amplified, especially in the more sort of emerging economies where there's just less underlying economic growth. And so we've certainly seen our private sector business across the African continent be heavily impacted across most sectors. Certainly, agriculture, for example, we've seen significant disruptions to supply chain over the course of last year. Obviously, tourism, food and hospitality has been completely decimated, with huge numbers of our clients really having to minimize their overhead costs and consequently reduce their security budgets. So that's definitely hurt. But on the flip side, we've also seen businesses and governments, NGOs, the entire sort of workforce really needing to react in a very proactive fashion to try and contain this unprecedented risk. And so that's brought quite a lot of opportunity in terms of our ability to work with clients to help work on everything from just operating procedures in terms of protocols for access control, screening, behavior in the office, shifts, cleaning, all of the stuff, in fact, that I know we're all living. But in fact, companies that are able to do this in an efficient and organized fashion have actually found it really quite enhancing in some respects to their own work cultures, especially where there have been significant numbers of people who've been able to work from home and just bring a level of sort of flexibility and at times real lifestyle improvement. So it's been very much a mixed bag.
And you mentioned there's disruption to supply chains throughout the pandemic, and obviously there's a sort of new imperative on supply chains, which is medication and vaccines and moving those safely. Have you been doing any work on that side, on supporting companies that are directly working in that area?
Yeah, I mean it's on the face of it, it's such an obvious challenge to be looking to address from a logistical standpoint, from a security standpoint. But the reality is that it's really only been very recent that that I think the mindset has shifted towards vaccine distribution from testing, and they're very different in terms of the approaches that organizations have to those two functions. Testing, I think, whilst I think a lot of companies were quite proactive in terms of committing to testing in the early stages. It was fairly quickly recognized that on very large scale, it was impractical to continue to do very regular frequency of testing to completely contain or avoid infection rates. So whilst I think people are continuing with testing, we very much see the focus being moving towards, or having moved towards, the actual sort of underlying trying to mitigate with proactive measures in terms of social distancing, masks, and hand cleaning and stuff. But actually the vaccine piece now is just the monumental challenge, and really trying to work out and unpack how that's going to work from a distribution standpoint. I think it remains to be seen, because certainly into Africa, the hundreds of millions of vaccines that are going to need to be distributed are being discussed with increasing amounts of anxiety at very senior strategic levels. And COVAX is the best example of that, between this collaboration between Gavi, the WHO, and UNICEF, to really work out how to partner or collaborate with governments and the private sector, the manufacturers, to really start to effect that that distribution over the course, hopefully, of this summer and beyond. Most certainly, the more developed African countries are going to, the governments are really going to retain a pretty tight control, certainly on the supply and as much of the distribution as they can. Ministries of health, for obvious reasons, are going to be, really determined to make sure that it remains, a government prerogative. But I think in environments, more remote environments, and where there aren't the sort of stable and established institutions of government that have got the infrastructure and the capacity and the capability to be able to effect this distribution, there needs to be a role for both the NGOs, but I think really importantly the private sector. And so looking at organizations like ourselves with and others, particularly in the logistics space, where one can have, or organizations can have, tens of thousands of employees and assets, logistics, vehicles, fleet in particular, tracking, to be able to really push out distribution into the more remote parts of the continent. I mean, that's going to be an enormous challenge. And as that starts, there are going to be challenges around counterfeiting, around just control of the supply chain, criminality, and monitoring. And then I think critically, and arguably most importantly, is going to be the whole engagement campaign, just to all around strategic communications, and really trying to ensure that there are high adoption rates and that people do take the vaccine, and that there isn't going to be huge numbers or a huge proportion of the population that have a skepticism that means that vaccine levels are not able to really get to the levels they need to bring infection rates down. And I think looking forwards, we're going to be living with this for a very long time. There are going to be increasing amounts of virus mutations. There's going to be, there will be more pandemics. And I think this public awareness, or the public health importance of here is something that has been unprecedented. And governments across the world now, I think, are going to recognize this, the criticality of getting this issue, distribution and management and oversight and monitoring of vaccines as being, truly, a global priority.
And in your experience, sort of working on the ground, particularly in Africa, but also globally, do you think we're learning the right lessons from this pandemic to be ready for future ones, or for continued mutations?
Yeah, I think there are lots of lessons being learnt. I think, but I also think it's really hard. This is a very long time. Nobody anticipated that we would be finding ourselves, 12 months on, a year later, still, looking down the barrel, of many more months of huge disruption to our lives and to our economies. And worse still, some of the these mutations now, the virus mutations, are becoming more deadly in Africa, and the spread is accelerating, and we're seeing death rates starting to increase with this third wave. And I think that's the most worrying piece here, is that this, I think, is a has the very real potential to be, an indicator of continuing waves and continuing high fatality rates, and something we're going to have to really learn to live with, and not see this as a sort of temporary, inconvenience to our lives, but really adapt, on a more enduring basis, to this real, behavioural change that has been driven by this pandemic.
And if we stick on Africa specifically, obviously we've spoken there about COVID and the particular challenges Africa faces there. But the unfortunate thing is also everything else doesn't stop at the same time. The African continent can often be sort of painted with one brush. So as you're looking at Africa now from a security perspective, and we've seen a number of sort of high-profile incidents recently in Mozambique, in Nigeria, in Ethiopia. Which countries are you looking at most closely when it comes to that sort of security risk?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head in terms of it's very easy to generalize, and the reality with so much to do with Africa is it's localized problems that are really need to be addressed on a on an individual or country specific basis. For us, there are a number of different challenges and security challenges that this pandemic is bringing. I think there are the short term ones, the ones that really are sort of facing us right now, and then longer term, further out, which I think require different approaches. I think the countries that have got sort of enduring security challenges, unrest and instability, places like Mozambique, like Somalia, northern Nigeria, and there are a number of other examples, parts of DRC, they have got and have had real security challenges that precede, of course, the pandemic, and they're certainly not going away. And in some respects, I think one could argue that they have really been kind of lesser impacted by this pandemic because of the underlying causes are sort of enduring, whether they be sort of economic or ethnic or a combination of the two. The challenges that I think we're looking forward are going to be facing more and more are around the emerging economic hardship as economies really slow down, as growth rates really go into negative territory, population levels start to increase again, as unemployment levels rise, education levels reduce, and particularly girls start to, we see higher dropout rates and increasing population rates with increasing numbers of pregnancies, we are going to see over the coming years major consequences of this with in the form of population growth and food scarcity and other sort of related issues, and those will create security issues in terms of public protest demonstrations and I think increasing frequency of them as well, and obviously more pressure on the governments to really address the underlying concerns that are causing the unrest in the first place, and that is, we're going to see more of that. And so, as ever, increasing onus on governments and on the international community to really be trying to be proactive and preempt some of these, I think, fairly predictable consequences.
And if we could perhaps go into a little more detail on sort of some of those cases, particularly Mozambique and what's been happening in northern Mozambique, because I know that you're very active in that region. What's your outlook at the moment? How much is it affecting the country as a whole? How much is it isolated in that one area? And how would you advise companies in Mozambique to approach the security situation there?
Well, I mean, as most of us know, Mozambique is an enormous country, and the north, particularly the Cabo Delgado area, where is the focus of this insurgency, is very, very distinctly separate from the south and from the capital of Maputo and the other sort of major cities in the middle. you know, it's a very real problem, and it's, you know, the insurgency is gathering steam. You know, it's becoming more and more brutal. Attacks becoming more frequent. They're increasing in scale and complexity, and you know, it's becoming more critical that you know, a credible security response, you know, on the part of the, you know, the Mozambican government, you know, really start to be implemented, because otherwise, you know, I think there is real concern that this you know, this can get away from itself and spread you know, more broadly, you know, in the country. And so I think for us, we're acutely aware of that. We're seeing, in fact, right now as I speak today, we've seen the town of Parma has been largely overcome by a significant militant attack on a scale that we haven't seen before, in terms of proximity to the Duat, to the main oil and gas enclosure, and to the town that is housing a lot of the sort of supporting community to that development. And you know, we are, you know, waiting with bated breath for a real, you know, strategic effort that can start to have, as I say, yeah, a meaningful impact on the security. And that's going to require significant engagement with the local communities, significant capacity building, training, and a real investment in the security forces, and quite how that unfolds in terms of the collaboration, especially with Total as the as the main IOC operating up there, I think remains to be seen. And it's an acutely complex issue. The answers, are not that obvious. I think ultimately, the general perception is that it's the responsibility of the government to work with other stakeholders, and, the investor community, to really try and come up with, a progressive, enduring, socially responsible, ethical solution that can really help develop the area with, maximum engagement and wealth creation and economic sort of progress and development for the local community.
And you mentioned a couple of things there that I'd like to pick up on. One being the role of the government, and then another one being the importance of engaging with local communities for companies. So perhaps we could start there and then move to the government. How important is that engagement with local communities in your approach to things? Not just somewhere like Mozambique, where you've got a sort of an insurgency situation, but also somewhere like Nigeria around the NSARS protests, or other places that are seeing social movements. How important is that piece in your advice to companies?
It's absolutely fundamental, and it's an integral part of our ethos, as a large scale employer, in trying to maximise the proportion of the workforce that can be recruited from the local communities. Creating jobs with vocational training is one of the most effective ways of meaningfully contributing to the local economy, and to ensure that there is a constructive, sort of equitable relationship with local communities. And that's one of the particular challenges up in northern Mozambique, as it is in other sort of rural parts of Africa, DRC and Somalia, in fact, and northern Nigeria also come to mind, where one does have very low levels of education, limited levels of engagement quite often, international stakeholders, there's a lot more that needs to be done by the international investor community to really come up with viable, enduring, long-term solutions that are sort of pragmatic and simple and effective, not overcomplicated, not necessarily overly costly, but that fundamentally have the best interests of the local communities at heart, to really build that local community engagement and over time, which often is a luxury, but getting these local communities to see the economic benefit of collaboration versus conflict.
And then the other element you were talking about there was obviously the government side, as much as as much as companies can work with local communities and create jobs, you know, there's a limit to how much they can do, particularly from a security perspective. So we've obviously seen a couple of transitions of power coming in the last few weeks, slightly unexpectedly with the death of President Magufuli, and then also in Libya with the transitional government taking power there. So perhaps if we start with Tanzania, what's your sort of outlook there? Do you think there'll be an impact on stability with the transfer of power happening, or are you feeling that it's a relatively stable situation nonetheless?
No, I mean, we're really, really hopeful, actually optimistic on both those fronts. And if we take them in turn, Tanzania, obviously with the shock, surprise death of President Magufuli, we're really hopeful actually that with the succession there, that we're going to see, a slightly more sort of, moderate tone of engagement towards the international community, because I think none of us who are significant investors in Tanzania could have foreseen the extent of the sort of duress on the international investor community over the last few years, and it's caused a very significant exodus of foreign capital and investment into the economy. And I think it's been absolutely to the detriment of the Tanzanian people. And so now, looking forwards, we are hopeful, as I think many are, that a bit more sort of collaboration and pragmatism can prevail to recognise the strategic value of international companies whose capital and skills, wherewithal, are really critical to the continued success and economic growth of Tanzania. So it's very early to call, obviously. I mean, it's extremely recent, these developments, but I think there is cause for optimism. But I think, as I say, let's not be too sort of too optimistic. And I think on Libya has been a really tragic situation, really, now for the best part of the last decade. Whilst Libya hasn't deteriorated into the same levels of insurgency that we've seen, elsewhere, particularly in the Middle East, some of the other sort of failed state environments, it has seen a complete collapse of the economy, a complete degradation of infrastructure, a total lack of investment, there have been numerous efforts, as we all know, brokered by the UN and other sort of international stakeholders, all with conflicting interests, competing interests, and really quite sort of polarized, particularly between the east and west of the country, and supporting the two respective sides. And now, with the formation of this new government, I think we are really hopeful that this can set the stage for the international investor community to start to feel a bit more confident that there are the sort of the foundations of a government starting to clear through the fog. But equally, we're going to continue to see spikes in violence, and we had a significant assassination yesterday in Benghazi, for example, of a senior military leader, that sort of violence, I think we're likely to see continue. But fundamentally, what we need is big investors, particularly for infrastructure, and oil and gas as well, to really commit to their plans that have been on hold for a number of years, and really just take that plunge and commit to getting going. And we are seeing two or three, for example, significant infrastructure projects that are just on the cusp of getting going in terms of power grid and other critical infrastructure investment. And we're just really hoping that it happens, and over the coming months, that the government is sufficiently, or this new government is sufficiently pragmatic to give the international community what they need in terms of security assurances, as well as the right sort of investment climate to commit.
And obviously, you know, we've been talking in quite a lot of detail about the variation across the African continent from a security perspective, and, you know, the importance of being specific about these issues. But there are some risks that are sort of more generalized, and I'm thinking particularly of climate change and some of the risks associated with that. How much is climate change affecting how businesses in Africa manage safety and security risks, do you feel? How much of a role is it coming to play in the work that you do?
I mean, I think it's an enormous topic subject, and, you know, if one really thinks about it, you know, so many of the sort of underlying security issues can be attributed to climate issues, whether that be food supply, whether it be natural disasters in terms of floods, for example, these have a direct impact on local communities and local environments, and from a security standpoint. I think we're beginning to see now some companies, especially those that are either with significant coastal infrastructure or just significant amounts of real estate, starting to consider or plan for some of these natural disasters as they become more frequent, and as businesses start to sort of notch up direct personal experience of some of these disasters. But there's definitely a lot more to be done. I think one of the challenges, of course, is anticipating, what that impact is going to be. Because almost by their very definition, natural disasters are sort of unexpected and kind of come out of nowhere. One needs to balance the costs of committing to that sort of levels, to those levels of preparedness quite often, with the likelihood of things happening. But I think, increasingly it's becoming something that, that organizations need to take seriously. We're beginning to see it, but I would say not perhaps as much as one might anticipate.
And so obviously, in general, you're operating in quite challenging environments. We've spoken about lots of different types of risks, from violence to, you mentioned natural disasters there, and disease. So across that sort of variety of challenges, how do you make sure that your employees are protected working in those environments, and also the people that they interact with? I imagine that would be quite a challenging ask from a sort of human rights perspective. How do you manage that challenge?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's we have a huge duty of care, responsibility to our workforce, we are very mindful of ensuring that we look out for our workforce and treat them as well as we can within the sort of realistic constraints of running a business that needs to be mindful of just being practical and realistic. So we're certainly very, I think, proactive in terms of trying to ensure that our workforce is healthy from a public health standpoint. We do assist our workforce, for example, with vaccinations, with clinics, certainly in remote locations where we employ people, obviously with drugs quite often that may not be readily available to rural communities where we have sort of rural operations. So I think we do quite a lot. I mean, could we be doing more? I think yes. But I think that's a constant effort. And I think, fundamentally it's about really trying to, back to this point around engagement with one's workforce and with local communities. It's trying to understand what people's needs are, and really, how do we sort of elevate our own perception of as being a good employer with our own workforce and addressing those needs.
Sort of to just a slight shift, but if you're looking towards the future, and actually another sort of another security consideration or risk that comes more cross-border is cybersecurity and that's taking a more central role in companies' strategies. How important? So often cybersecurity gets overlooked in Africa because people don't think of it so readily. What's your take on that? How important is cybersecurity to companies in Africa? Is it moving up the list of risks that you should be watching out for?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. And cybersecurity is a huge sort of term that I think could be quite intimidating to many of us because we often aren't quite sure what that means, or it can mean so many different things. I mean, I think there are a number of issues that are becoming more and more important from a security standpoint for organizations, particularly those with large numbers of employees. The whole security around social media, I think, is really important. Being able to monitor what's being said about an organization, being able to track whether there are threats manifesting themselves, what the underlying sentiment or attitude is towards a company in the vicinity of where companies have operations. I think that's something that's becoming increasingly easy to do and increasingly cost effective, and so we do quite a lot of consultancy around that, and there are a number of sort of off-the-shelf solutions, but the trick is really trying to ensure that it actually gives the gives the data, the information, the tangible, usable information to really mitigate risk from an employer standpoint, and that sometimes can I think can really benefit from some real expertise. And then I think more broadly in terms of bringing the application of technology and the sort of fusion of physical hardware in terms of security systems and integrating that with software, reducing the dependency more and more on hardware, security hardware, and particularly given the pace of development and of sort of obsolescence of so much hardware, I think there is more and more opportunity to be using maximizing software in that sort of context of cybersecurity, and to be using an integrated approach to really just address a number of different security issues, from the obvious around visual monitoring of cameras, but also behavioral monitoring is really important, and we do a lot of implementation and management of security systems to really track behavior of employees, because I think that can be the most proactive and preemptive indicators of behavior that's nefarious or against the best interests of an organization.
And so would you say that, do you expect tech to take on a greater role in your operations in the future going forwards?
No, absolutely, and I think it's amplified during periods of sort of economic hardship, and I think that's one of the real benefits actually for us at the moment in these pretty tough economic times, because it's forcing us to really be progressive and to look at how we can quite often reduce sort of running costs in terms of labor in particular, and numbers of guards in our case, and sort of evolve with an investment, a capital investment in infrastructure that can be very complementary to a security workforce, but actually can be much more efficient, bring costs down in the immediate term, but also the longer term, and ultimately end up with a much more sort of effective solution for containing risk. And I think for us, whilst I think a number of security companies look at the immediate threat of reductions in security workforce, I think we actually don't see it like that, and one shouldn't. One should see it really as being progressive, and actually it brings a lot more sort of job security in the long term, and it enables people or companies like ourselves to differentiate ourselves, to make us more integrated with the companies that we work with our clients, and really be seen as truly a sort of collaborative partner in the management of risk.
And now, so Oliver, I always sort of wrap up with asking people to sort of look to the future and give me sort of something they're feeling optimistic about, as sort of more challenging perhaps in your line of work where you are trained to see and prepare for the risks. But if you're looking, you know, if you're looking at Africa, is there a country or a sector that you've watched over the last few years, or that you sort of are feeling particularly optimistic about in the future, sort of in spite of obviously all of the challenges we've discussed today?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a difficult one too. I mean, I think what I feel most excited about actually is really trying to, you know, harness the power, the innovation, the intellect of an incredibly capable, you know, emerging young workforce. I think traditionally and certainly in our sector, we've always been, I think, erred on the side of an older workforce because we perceive it to be, you know, a bit more sort of predictable, a bit easier to manage and a bit more disciplined. But actually, I think, you know, that there's an enormous opportunity, to harness so much of the innovation that's coming out of, the younger African workforce. And we need to be, creative within our security industry to see how we can embrace that. And to your point around, the increasing value of technology, in security, to my mind, that is, the absolute marriage of those two. Sector-wise, I think there's lots of interesting sectors, whether it's alternative energy, whether it's progressive agricultural techniques and increasing yield and productivity. I think that's very exciting. I think continuing innovation and efficiency around manufacturing is hugely exciting. And I think as Africa's infrastructure continues to develop and logistics becomes more and more easier in terms of moving goods around the continent, that we're going to see enormous amounts of growth and the benefit of more and more of Africa's produce and needs, products being produced closer to home rather than importing. So I think there's a huge amount to play for, and it's very exciting.
Oliver, thank you so much for coming on to speak to us today. For more information about GardaWorld and the work you do, there will be some links in the description. So I would encourage everybody to follow those if you're interested in learning a bit more.
Thanks very much. Most welcome. Thanks, Eleanor.
Thanks, Oliver.